Today I'd like to deal largely with the church in Jerusalem. We have already looked at the church in Jerusalem in our very opening study, where we contrasted Jerusalem and Antioch. So in a sense, I've half done my job already. But there are other things relevant to this section of Acts. And before we look at Jerusalem, let's pick up the connections from our previous study. Now you'll recall that Paul had come to Ephesus, and he spent 3 years there in Ephesus. Now his plan was that he would move up through Troas and across into Macedonia and then down into Achaia, or Greece. And then after that he wanted to go to Jerusalem, and from there he intended to go to Rome. You'll find it all outlined in chapter 19, verse 21. This is going back more or less summarizing what we talked about last time. Now after these events, that's events that took place in Ephesus, Paul resolved in the Spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia, and then to go to Jerusalem, saying, "After I have been there, to Jerusalem, I must also see Rome." However, he stayed, it says in the last few words of verse 22, it says that he stayed in Asia for a while. And while he stayed there in Asia, in Ephesus, he had correspondence with the church across the water there in Corinth. He had a visit, we saw. And he had some rather sharp letters that he had to write to them. He wrote 1 Corinthians and then another rather severe letter. And after this, he did in fact move off as he has planned in the verse we just read. He moved off from Ephesus up to Troas, and then he got a boat from Troas and went across to Macedonia. And we find that he met Titus there. Titus, who had taken that very severe letter across to Corinth, came back the other way, and they met up there in Macedonia. And Paul was so relieved that he wrote off what we call 2 Corinthians. And he sent it back with Titus, but he himself stayed up there for a while, visiting some of those churches and slowly moving down towards Corinth. So you find that in the opening couple of verses of chapter 20. This is more or less our starting point, building on from where we left off last time. After the uproar ceased, that is, there was a riot in Ephesus, after that ceased, Paul sent for the disciples, and having exhorted them, he took leave of them, and he departed for Macedonia, as we saw last time. There he met Titus, and when he had gone through those parts and given them much encouragement, he came to Greece, which is Achaia, down the bottom there. And he spent 3 months there, we are told in verse 3. Now, during those 3 months, Paul wrote his letter to the church in Rome. We have just seen in Acts 19 that he intended to go to Rome, but firstly he said, "I'm going to Jerusalem." He had just also written a letter to the Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, that he'd written about 2 months previously. And in that, likewise, he said, "I intend to expand further west. But firstly, I want you people in Corinth to be stable and to know where you're going. Here I come to help you." And so at present he's now in Corinth, helping them to get stable, because he's planning to move further west to Rome. If you go across to the letter to Romans, just keep your finger there in Acts for a while, we'll go across to Romans chapter 1. And we'll see how it all ties together. Paul at this stage had never been to Rome, and he was hoping that he'd be able to make the trip fairly soon. In Romans chapter 1, verse 10, he says that he asks that somehow, by God's will, I may now at last succeed in coming to you. He said, "I long to see you," that is you people in Rome, "that I may impart to you some spiritual gift to strengthen you, that is, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith, both yours and mine. I want you to know, brethren, that I have often intended to come to you, but thus far have been prevented, in order that I may reap some harvest among you, as well as among the rest of the Gentiles." He wanted to see this church in Rome really strengthened, because Paul saw Rome as the center of the empire. Well, it was the center of the empire, but he saw that if Christianity was really firmly established there in Rome, well, this would be a further launching pad, if I can use that word, a further jumping off point for the expansion into other parts. There was already a church there in Rome, and we'll be discussing that in the final of these studies, seeing how it was first formed and how it developed. But Paul wants to make sure that these people know what they're on about when it comes to the gospel, because if Rome, the center of the empire, has got it wrong, you can rest assured that other places will get it wrong as well. So Paul wants to go there and see that they really are stable. But first of all, he sends them this letter. And in the letter, of course, he gives them the basic teaching of Christianity, what it's all about, so that they will know all about the doctrines of salvation and how the Christian should live. If you go across to chapter 15, verse 24, you'll find again that he says here what he has just said to the Corinthians and what we have also read in the book of Acts. Chapter 15, verse 24. He said, "I hope to see you soon as I go on to Spain and to be sped on my journey there by you once I have enjoyed your company for a little." But firstly, he's got to go to Jerusalem. As it says in Acts and as it says in Corinthians, he first of all has to go to Jerusalem. And you know why? He has been collecting this money among all the churches so that he can take it to help the poor Christians in Jerusalem. Now, we know right from the beginning that Paul was really concerned about this friction that existed between Jerusalem and the Gentile churches. And he wanted the Jerusalem church to feel at one with the Gentile churches. And the Christians in Jerusalem were very worried about Paul, his mission to the Gentiles, and the fact that he didn't adhere to the requirements of the Jewish rituals. So he said, "I'll collect all this money, which will have a twofold benefit. One, it will help the poor Christians in Jerusalem. But two, it will show those Christians that these Gentile churches really are united with them." So all the different places he had been around Asia Minor, Achaia and Macedonia, he had been taking this money. And now a representative from each of these churches was going to go with Paul to Jerusalem, hand it over to the church there, and say to these Jewish Christians, "There you are, you see, we Gentile churches are just the same as you. We're all one in Christ, and we want you to accept this as a sign of our fellowship with you." It was a major project of Paul's. He'd been planning it for years. And as I've mentioned, it is dealt with at length in 1 Corinthians, again in 2 Corinthians, and he mentions it again here in Romans, in chapter 15, verse 25. He has just said he wants to come and visit them and then go on to Spain, but he says in verse 25, "At present, I've got to go to Jerusalem with this money that I've collected for the Christians there." Verse 26, "For Macedonia and Achaia," now note again the two areas we've just been concerned with, that's where he has recently been and where he is, "Macedonia and Achaia have been pleased to make some contribution for the poor among the saints at Jerusalem, and they were pleased to do it. And indeed they are in debt to them, for if the Gentiles have come to share in their spiritual blessings, they ought also to be service to them in material things. And then when I've completed this, when I've handed over the cash and I've delivered to them what has been raised, I shall go on to see you and then pass on by way of you to Spain." This letter that Paul wrote to the Romans, he sent to Rome by a woman called Phoebe. Now Phoebe was a member of the church at Kenchreae, which was the port just near Corinth. Corinth, you can see, is on the west, opening onto some water there, and to the right you have Kenchreae, which opens onto the water on this side. And ships went from both sides to various parts of the world. This woman from Kenchreae, Phoebe, was going to Rome, so she came across to Corinth to get the ship and to head off west to Rome. And in verse 1 of chapter 16, Paul tells us that he's commending this lady to them, this lady Phoebe. He said she's a deaconess of the church at Kenchreae. And in verse 2, he says to receive her in the Lord and to help her in whatever she requires. And she's the one, I would say, that took the letter. And if you just come down to verse 23, you find that Paul is staying in Corinth with this man Gaius. Gaius was one of the people that Paul had baptized in Corinth. You'll find that referred to in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. That's all by the way. If we just go back now to Acts chapter 20, we'll see what happens from here on. Paul has written off the letter to the church in Rome. He's told them that he intends now to go to Jerusalem to hand over this money. And after he spent his 3 months there in Corinth, he commenced his journey back. He moved back up through Macedonia once again. And on the way, various people joined him. You'll find them referred to in verse 4. It mentions the representatives of these various churches that went with Paul to Jerusalem on this journey. These men that are all mentioned in verse 4, in verse 5 we find that they went on and waited for Paul at Troas, but Paul and Luke and the others who were with him were in Philippi in verse 6, and then later on they sailed from Philippi and went across to Troas where they joined the others. Now this tells us again that Luke has now rejoined the party. You have the word we did this and we went there. Can you cast your mind back to a few previous studies? And I said that when Luke first joined them on a Paul's second missionary journey, Luke stayed behind in Philippi when Paul and his party moved on. Well, now Paul comes back to Philippi, Luke rejoins them, and from now on you'll find that Luke is with Paul for the whole of the rest of the book of Acts, and that's why the remaining chapters of Acts are given in such great detail, because Luke was an eyewitness of the whole lot. Not only that, it appears to me that Luke stayed with Paul for about the next 5 years, right through his couple of years imprisonment in Caesarea, on the journey to Rome, and then later on Paul's 2 year imprisonment in Rome, Luke was always there. So Luke, Paul, Timothy, and then all these representatives from these various churches sail away. They leave Troas up there, and in verse 17 they come to Miletus, which was a town just near Ephesus. Paul called the elders from the church at Ephesus to come and meet him there, and he gave them instruction because he saw that troublous times were ahead. There would be false teaching, and he wanted to help these elders to stand firm, because if a church hasn't got strong elders, it really is open to the infiltration of all sorts of wrong ideas. And that was what was the danger at Ephesus. So Paul wanted to strengthen these elders of the church at Ephesus. We'll be looking at that in a couple of studies' time. Well, they sailed on from Ephesus and came around the corner here, around the bottom, the southwest corner of Asia Minor, past a couple of islands called Kos and Rhodes, which are mentioned in chapter 21, verse 1. And they went right through past Crete, past Cyprus, and headed off the map, until eventually they hit Palestine. And they landed at a place called Tyre, which is mentioned in verse 3. From Tyre they visited Christians in Ptolemais in verse 7. And then from there they went to Caesarea in verse 8. And finally in verse 17 they arrived in Jerusalem. And now the fun starts. Paul is now in Jerusalem. Notice in verse 17 that it says, when they had come to Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. On the following day, Paul went with us to James, and all the elders were present. James was the chief man there, and the other elders with James, they all met with Paul and his party. Verse 19, after greeting them, Paul related one by one the things that God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry, and when they heard all this, they glorified God. So things are going well so far. But then they point out that Paul isn't aware, maybe, that since he was last in Jerusalem, things have got worse, not better. The Jewish conservatives now number thousands, and they've become more conservative. They've become more bogged down in the Jewish traditions than they were previously. Verse 20, "You see, brother," say the elders of the church in Jerusalem, "how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed. They are all zealous for the law." Thousands of them, they're in the church there in Jerusalem, but yet they're still zealous for the law. And they're very upset in verse 21. "They have been told about you, that you teach all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children or observe the customs." They're worried about you, these men are saying. They think Paul is just a little bit off the track. They're not so much concerned that Paul is evangelizing the Gentiles. Now, previously, if you cast your mind back to, I think it was our second study, they said that these Gentile converts have to be circumcised and follow the law of Moses. Well, they were quietened on that one. But now, they're not so much concerned about Paul preaching to the Gentiles, whether they follow the law of Moses or whether they don't. But what they're worried about now is that Paul is preaching the Jewish converts, teaching the Jewish converts that they don't have to be circumcised or observe the law of Moses. And that really has got them worried now. It was bad enough when Paul was saying to the Gentiles, you don't have to follow the law of Moses, but even the Jewish converts to Christianity don't have to follow the law of Moses. They were incensed, and they were after Paul's blood. So these leaders in the church suggested that Paul demonstrate to everybody that he was a good, straight, orthodox Jew. They said, we suggest to you that you take these couple of chaps here and you go through a ceremony with them. Take a vow upon yourself, purification ceremony, go to the temple, carry out the usual requirements, and this will show them that you're not anti-Jewish. And Paul went ahead and did it. Now the question, of course, we all ask ourselves is, was he right in doing it? I don't think there's any doubt in Paul's mind that he was right in doing it, because he had this principle of operation that to the Jews he would become a Jew, to the Greeks he would become a Greek, so that he might win them. If there was no fundamental principle being broken, then he was quite happy to accommodate to different groups of people. He would not compromise on the issues of what constituted Christianity, what was the basis of faith. But when it came to these lesser matters, matters that weren't so essential, Paul was quite accommodating to some of these people, and so he took upon himself this vow. Not only do people argue as to whether Paul was correct in entering this purification ceremony with these chaps, but some of them even argue as to whether Paul did the right thing at all in coming to Jerusalem. Because if you read some of the passages we've skipped over, you'll find that sometimes people warned Paul through the Spirit not to go to Jerusalem. And others said, if you do go, you'll get bound. And Paul said, I am going, and don't you people try to turn me off. And so the question that people raise is, did Paul do the right thing? Was he being stubborn? Should he have obeyed the instructions these prophets gave him? Well, I guess we can debate it one way or the other. The only thing I'd suggest is that we go steady. It's very, very easy for us to pass a judgment on somebody else when we ourselves have never been in that position. I very much doubt if any of us have quite been in the position Paul was in, where he was threatened. His life was in jeopardy. It was a touch-and-go situation, you might say. So, if we want to hold an opinion one way or the other, let us do so with certain reservations. If we were in the same position, how clever would we be? And when you come to the second issue concerning the rite, the ceremony that Paul carried out at the temple, whether he was correct in doing this or not, one thing we can be certain of, it wasn't a success. Because you find that people soon found a way of getting at him. There's an old saying that there's more than one way of killing a cat, and if you couldn't get Paul one way, you could get him another. Now, Paul had gone out of his way to try to please the Jerusalem Jews. He really did want the Jerusalem Jews to be at one with the Gentiles. And the Jerusalem Jews were very happy to accept the cash that Paul and his friends brought, but it didn't really make all that much difference to their attitude. Paul was so concerned with pacifying the Jerusalem Jews that he'd forgotten all about the Asian Jews. And it was the Asian Jews who had dogged Paul's footsteps wherever he went. Remember, he'd been thrown out of one city and thrown out of another city and stoned somewhere else and forced to leave somewhere else and thrown out of the synagogue somewhere else. It was always these Jews of Asia Minor that were against Paul. They had trailed him to Jerusalem, and they were the ones that eventually brought him trouble. Verse 27. The 7 days were almost up, almost a success, the ceremony almost finished, but then the Jews from Asia who had come to Jerusalem, determined to get Paul, when they had seen him in the temple, they stirred up the crowd of people, and they accused Paul of taking a Gentile person into the temple. It wasn't true, but never mind, the accusation was good enough, and before you know where you are, there was a riot. And Paul had to be rescued only by the skin of his teeth. This church in Jerusalem, you can see how it reflects its own society. The church will always reflect the society in which it is situated. Now, we've seen this in Corinth. Corinth was a wild city, and you might say that the Corinthian church was a bit of a wild church. We're going to see later on that in Rome, there was a very anti-Jewish feeling among the people as a whole. And when you come to the church, we're going to see again that there was an anti-Jewish feeling in the church in Rome. In Jerusalem, there was an anti-Gentile feeling among the people as a whole. And that, again, carried over into the church. So it's natural that the type of environment we live in, the type of community we live in, you're going to see things carrying over from that into the church, whether we like it or not. And here you see it, of course, in Jerusalem. One of the things about Christianity is how it works wherever it is. And you can be here, or in some other place, or in some other country, or some other culture, or some other language group, but wherever you are, you'll find that Christianity can fit into that situation. Now, you won't find this with all religions of the world, because some religions of the world are so tied down to one particular country and culture that they simply don't fit anywhere else. But the thing about Christianity is that wherever we are, we can still find that it can work, because Christ comes and lives within us and changes us from within. And even though we may reflect certain cultural tendencies or patterns in our church life, yet the basics are always the same. Our salvation is always the same. The one we worship is always the same. The requirements morally laid upon us are all the same. These are the things that we should be emphasizing. There's a great variety in the churches of the New Testament, and sometimes I think we're unaware of it. Sometimes we tend to think that there's a universal pattern for the church, which you find in all the churches of the New Testament. But when you look at it, it's not like that at all. We read about certain things in some churches, and we have no idea at all as to whether those things applied in other churches. Things might have been quite different. For example, we find that Paul himself appointed elders in the churches of Galatia. But the churches of Crete didn't have any elders at all, and Paul hadn't founded them, and then later on he sends Timothy along to appoint them. That's quite a different procedure there. We have instructions to the church in Corinth concerning the operation of, let us say, tongues in the church, because it was a problem there and people were doing rash things and saying the wrong thing and generally creating confusion. But we have no idea of what happened in Philippi. We don't even know if tongues operated in the church in Philippi. If they did operate, well, apparently they operated so smoothly that there was no need to write to them to correct some of the disorders. But you see what I mean? We don't have a pattern that says everything was exactly the same in every one of these churches. The only things we find out about how these churches operated, and this is important, I feel, the only things we find out concern those things that went wrong. Now, I would imagine a lot of things didn't go wrong. And as long as things weren't going wrong, Paul didn't have to correct them. But all those things we find out in Corinth were because things went wrong in Corinth. And so he had to write and straighten them out on all these different issues. And as he corrects the wrong things that were being done, so we learn what the right thing to do is. But as I say, you might come to a place like Philippi, or Antioch in Galatia, or Berea, where there may have been no major disturbance or trouble, and so Paul doesn't have to write to them concerning those troubles, and just how they functioned or what they did, well, we have no way of exactly knowing. So the point I'm getting at is this. We must always grasp the essentials. And I think the essentials are those that are announced in that favourite verse of ours in Acts chapter 2, verse 42. They continued in the apostles' doctrine and the fellowship and the breaking of bread and the prayers. So what we must be doing is concentrating on fellowship, on praying, on worship, the breaking of bread, the scriptures, the apostles' doctrine being taught, going out and witnessing as these people were doing. How we do those things may vary from place to place. The important thing is that we do them. And that's what the Bible's concerned about. And unfortunately, many Christians you'll meet get hung up on arguments with each other as to how they should do them. And in the course of arguing about things, they never get around to doing what they're arguing about. So we're arguing about procedures and forms and regulations and that sort of thing. And the very basis that we should be concerned about, which is outreach, the preaching of the gospel, worship and prayer, so often these things seem to get lost in a maze of discussion on the methods, on the forms, on the procedures. As I say, each place works out these things largely for itself, and the Bible is very accommodating to people in different places and the different atmosphere of these different cities and the different churches. Let us make sure that we are concerned with those important things, and then we work them out as to how we're going to put them into practice. So we have this church at Jerusalem, which was, of course, so different from some of these other churches, and I'm afraid that here the whole thing backfired. Paul's attempt to win the favour of these people didn't work, and a riot followed. Well, you find that they tried to lynch him, and as you move on into chapter 22, Paul addressed the crowd, and he calmed them down by trying to point out what his calling was. But he only got about as far as verse 20, or 21, when he said that God had told him to depart, because God was going to send him to the Gentiles. And as soon as they heard that in verse 22, they listened no longer, and they said, such a fellow is not fit to live. Let's kill him. And so they proceeded to try to kill him. And Paul had to be rescued by the army commander in Jerusalem. This army commander didn't know much about things, and he was going to beat Paul until he found out that Paul was a Roman citizen, and that you couldn't just beat up a Roman citizen like that, so he went steady for a while. And he thought, well, maybe I should send him to the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin, and the Jewish council can investigate and find out what they can come up with concerning his wrongdoing. So in chapter 23, the army commander sends Paul along to the Jewish council. It only takes about 5 minutes for Paul to realize that he is not going to get any justice there. They are biased against him, and they are not even going to listen to reason. But Paul was very alert. He had a few tricks up his sleeve. He saw that some of them were Pharisees and some of them were Sadducees. And that's like trying to have Labour Party and National Party in the one room, trying to enjoy each other's company. So once he saw that there was a certain potential friction there, he said, well, actually, I'm a Pharisee by upbringing, and the things the Pharisees believe, such as the resurrection of the dead and that sort of thing, he said, I believe all those things. And immediately, of course, the Pharisees thought he wasn't such a bad chap after all, and the Sadducees thought he was much worse than they thought, and they're tearing at each other's throats, and Paul got caught up in between and almost got torn in bits. So once again, the Roman soldiers had to come and rescue him. Well, what are they going to do with this chap? The Roman commander decides, I'll wash my hands of it, I'll pass the buck. I'll send him down to Caesarea where he can go to the provincial governor, and then the governor can work out what he wants. So away Paul goes from Jerusalem down to Caesarea on the coast, where he is under the control of the Roman governor. It's very sad, I feel, as you think of this picture of Paul leaving Jerusalem. If there was one church that Paul really wanted with all his heart to go well, it was the church in Jerusalem, and it was the one that failed. It's a sort of experience I guess many of us have had, but I guess that's the way it is. We're just not to drop our bundle because of that. But it is sad, isn't it? The very thing that you would most want to go well, that's the very one that seems to go flop. And so Paul had to leave Jerusalem for the last time, and he never saw his hope of harmony between the Jewish and Gentile sections of the church fulfilled. Down he went there to Caesarea. He was brought before the governor, and the Jews set up their barrister to lay down the law as to why Paul was wrong. You come to it in chapter 24. There's a couple of things here that are worth looking at. There are three main accusations that they make against Paul. In chapter 24, verse 5, we found this man a pestilent fellow, an agitator among all the Jews throughout the world. In other words, they blamed Paul for the uprising. They said, in modern terminology, he's a stirrer. That's their first accusation. He stirs up trouble. Secondly, the end of verse 5, he's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. That's what they called the Christians, the sect of the Nazarenes. And he's a ringleader of it, and that's illegal. Under the Roman constitution, all the religions had to be legalized. And the Jews, of course, were an official licensed religion. The sect of the Nazarenes is unlawful. He's a ringleader of an illegal religion. That's the second accusation. And the third accusation is in verse 6. He even tried to profane the temple. Well, they're the three charges. Paul now comes up and he answers those three charges one by one. Firstly, concerning the charge that he is a stirrer and that he has created the riot in Jerusalem, he says in verse 12, it's false. They did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple or in the synagogue or in the city. So that's how he answers that accusation. The second accusation, that he was the leader of an illegal religion, he answers by saying, I am not the leader of an illegal religion. He says, you might say in brackets, it's understood almost, that he's saying, if anybody's wrong, it's the Jews, not me. Because Christianity is the true successor of the Old Testament Jewish religion. Christianity is the fulfillment of the Jewish religion, which is right, isn't it? That's a good argument to have. Because it was all for a preparation for Christ, and so Christ has come, and he said, I am the one that's in the true succession of the Old Testament prophets, because they pointed to Christ, and Christ has come, and so we are the right religion. It's the Jews that are wrong. They're the ones that haven't followed through properly. So in verse 14, he says, I admit to you that according to the way, as we mentioned previously, was a name for Christianity, according to the way, which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers. Our fathers, of course, the Jewish fathers, going back to the Old Testament. I believe everything, he says, laid down in the law and in the prophets. And I have a hope in God that these themselves accept that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. I believe the Old Testament, and I'm following in the paths that God has laid down right since the beginning. So I'm not the one that's off track. They're the ones that are off the track. So that's how he counters that argument. And the third accusation, he had defiled the temple. Nonsense, he said. I did not come here to defile the temple. Actually, I came to give them money. And he said, if you look at verse 17, after some years I came to bring to my nation alms and offerings. And in verse 18, as I was doing this, they found me purified in the temple. They didn't defile the temple, they found me purified in the temple. So all three accusations are false. Well, we find that Felix, the governor, listened, and he quite clearly understood that Paul wasn't guilty. The Jews had just been making all this up, and they were determined to get rid of him, just like the Jews got rid of Jesus. Any accusation will do, as long as we get rid of him. And just like Pilate had seen that for envy the Jews delivered up Jesus, so Felix saw that it was the same type of spirit in the Jews that had handed over Paul. Paul wasn't guilty, but Felix dare not let him go, because if Felix let Paul go, there might be more trouble. So what's the easiest thing to do? Simple, keep him locked up. So in verse 27, he kept Paul locked up. In fact, Paul was locked up for 2 years until the next governor arrived. And when the next governor arrived, he could do what he liked. Nice type, isn't he, this Felix? He just leaves Paul locked up for 2 years so that he has an easy way out. If Paul had bribed him, of course, he could have got free. But Paul wasn't up to that sort of trick, so Paul sat it out in prison for 2 years. When Festus arrived, the next governor, he'd no sooner got there than the Jews came and accused Paul before Festus. Now notice how long Paul's been locked up so far. He had this riot in Jerusalem, he's now been in prison for 2 years, and then we have later on we're going to find the journey to Rome, and then as a result of all this he has another 2 year imprisonment in Rome. So for 5 years he's locked up virtually. That's one of the other reasons you might say that this wasn't a success. This entering the ceremony for 7 days landed him in jail for 5 years. That's not really successful, is it? The only success is that it got him to Rome free. The government paid the trip, and he eventually got there. Insofar as it worked that way, I suppose you can say it was successful. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Come back to chapter 25. This man Festus, he was the new governor. Well, he didn't have a clue as to how to handle a case. He didn't know anything about all these Jewish fanatics in Jerusalem. He'd never governed Jerusalem before, and he didn't know all the ins and outs of what things the Jews did and what they didn't do. So he said to Paul, well, maybe we'll go back to Jerusalem and judge it there. He was trying to please the Jews, you see. Everybody tried to please the Jews, because if you didn't please the Jews, you had a fight on your hands. So any governor knew that you keep them calm. And Paul said, look, this is unjust. The army commander in Jerusalem didn't find me guilty. The Jewish council, the Sanhedrin, they didn't find me guilty. Felix, the governor, didn't find me guilty. You haven't found me guilty, and I'm still locked up here. I've had enough of this injustice. I appeal to Caesar. That was his right, and so he appealed to Caesar. Okay, said Festus, you've appealed to Caesar. I suppose you've got to go to Caesar. There's just one problem. Festus had no idea what he was guilty of. So he looked a bit of a fool sending this man to Caesar and not being able to write down the accusation against him. Just then, Festus's skin was saved. A man arrived called Herod Agrippa. He was the last surviving member of the family of Herod the Great, the man that tried to kill the baby Jesus. This man had no power. He was what you might call in England they have barons and dukes and lords, which people who have no power but they've got good titles. Well, that's what Agrippa was like. Well, he came along, and he said, yes, I'll listen to Paul to see what he's got to say. Because Festus, you see, said to Agrippa, look, I've got this character here. I haven't a clue what it's all about. Can you listen to him and see if you can make sense out of it? So Agrippa listened to Paul's defense. And in chapter 26, verse 3, Paul says, I'm very pleased. Thank goodness at last I've got somebody to speak to who understands what I'm talking about. He says to King Agrippa, you are especially familiar with all the customs and controversies of the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. Agrippa listened very patiently, and for the rest of chapter 26, Paul explained to Agrippa what the problem was. And Agrippa likewise found that Paul was not guilty. Look at the very last verse, verse 32. Agrippa said to Festus, this man could have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. So now, what are we going to do? Well, they now have to send off Paul to Rome. This means now that we're going to have a long sea journey, and I'm not going to go into it in great detail, but it's all outlined for us in chapter 27. You find at the opening couple of verses of chapter 27 that Luke was still with Paul. Embarking on a ship which was about to sail to various ports, we put to sea. We, meaning the writer of the book, was there with Paul, so Luke and Paul, and also a man called Aristarchus. And you'll notice that Aristarchus and Luke stay with Paul for quite a long time. So off they go, and it's a very eventful sea voyage. We're not going to go into details about this sea voyage. They had various adventures, and as you know, they were wrecked and eventually finished up on the island of Malta. Stayed there for another 3 months until the bad weather was over. In the end, they picked up a ship which took them to Rome. And so you come to chapter 28, verse 16, and Paul arrives in Rome. He was under house arrest, you might say. He was chained to a Roman guard, and he was imprisoned without actually being in jail. He was able to live in his own hired house, but he was chained to a Roman soldier just to make sure he didn't get away, and he stayed there for 2 years. But the first thing you notice he does when he gets to Rome is to invite the leaders of the Jews to come and see him. Always to the Jew first. That was Paul's principle of operation. Well, the Jews came along, and they hadn't heard of all the rioting in Jerusalem, but never mind, they listened to Paul just the same. So in verse 17, after 3 days, he called together the local leaders of the Jews, and when they had gathered, he said to them, "Brethren, though I have done nothing against the people or the customs of our fathers, yet I was delivered prisoner from Jerusalem into the hands of the Romans," and he goes on and explains what happened. Well, the Jews listened, but as so often happened, they took no notice. And when they took no notice, Paul repeated the words that we saw earlier in Acts chapter 13 when he went to the synagogue at Antioch. He said, more or less, "It was necessary for the gospel to be preached to you first, but seeing you don't listen to it, I'll turn to the Gentiles." And now here in the very center of the empire, at Rome, where I've always wanted to come, as usual my first obligation is to the Jews, and as usual you have rejected it, therefore as usual I will turn to the Gentiles and take the message to them myself, direct. So in verse 27, he quotes from the Old Testament to justify his belief that these Jews are people whose hearts have grown dull, their ears are heavy of hearing, their eyes have been closed. They simply won't listen. Verse 28, "Let it be known to you, therefore, that this salvation of God has been sent to the Gentiles, and they will listen." And so Paul lived there for 2 whole years at his own expense. He welcomed all who came to him. He preached the kingdom of God, and he taught about the Lord Jesus Christ quite openly and unhindered. And that's a good triumphant note to finish on. This man Luke has been writing this book for us. He's been writing the Gospel of Luke and now the Acts of the Apostles. He wants to give a chap called Theophilus a trustworthy account of the growth of Christianity from the birth of its founder to the arrival of its greatest apostle in Rome. And now he's completed the story, and he completes it on his very triumphant note that although Paul was imprisoned, nevertheless he was able to preach freely in Rome itself. And so the gospel has arrived there in the person of Paul. Actually, the gospel was there previously because there were already Christians there. But Paul, who was the great apostle to the Gentiles, the one to whom God had entrusted this ministry especially, now he is in Rome, and he is preaching openly and unhindered in Rome. And on that triumphant note, Luke closes his story. But that's not the end of the story for us, because you find that Paul is a hard man to put down. And as you go on, you're going to find now that he meets people who come to Rome, all sorts of people. He still writes letters. Letters go out to various churches. And after a while, he's released. After 2 years imprisonment, he was released, and he went on further journeys, and he wrote further letters. He had a lot more work to do for God yet. And we'll look at those in our final 3 studies. So we've seen now the churches of Antioch, Galatia, Thessalonica, Corinth, and Jerusalem. And in the next 3 studies, I want to look at the churches of Colossae, Ephesus, and finally, Rome.